Hello to everyone in the United States and in Israel and Palestine and other places in the world. I want to welcome you all to this latest installment of Conversations with Israel and Palestine. This is a webinar series hosted by Partners for Progressive Israel. Conversations with Israel and Palestine is, as I said, a series of informational webinars that brings together voices from Israel and Palestine to an American audience, and it aims to provide an important link between progressives in the United States and in the Middle East. My name is Rabbi Deborah Waxman, and I am the president of Reconstructing Judaism, the central organization of the Reconstructionist movement. We're based here in the United States. We have congregations in Canada, in Europe, God willing, soon in Israel. And over the next 60 minutes, I'll be serving as the discussion moderator. Our topic today is focused on women, Judaism, and Israel. We are convening just as news is breaking in Israel. Lots of interesting things going on, but we're going to keep our focus on the topic that we advertised on women, Judaism, and Israel. Before we get started, let me note that Partners for Progressive Israel is an American nonprofit 501c3 organization that is dedicated to the achievement of a durable and just peace between Israel and its neighbors. And it believes that in the need to ensure civil rights, equality, and social justice for all of Israel's inhabitants. Partners seeks to deepen Americans, and especially American Jews' understanding of Israel's complexities in order to enhance our ability to advocate for a progressive Israeli future. So I am so honored today to be on this panel, to moderate this panel with our two extraordinary panelists. With us today are Anat Hoffman, who is the executive director of the Israel Religious Action Center. She served in that role since 2002. Prior to that, she was a Jerusalem City Councilwoman for 14 years, and she was a founding member of Women of the Wall, and has served on the boards of the Israel Women's Network, the Association for Civil Rights in Israel, and many, many other organizations working on Tikkun Olam, working for social justice. And with us as well is Yael Rockman, who has been the executive director of Kolech since 2015. She is an attorney who is also currently working on her master's degree in gender studies. All of her studies have been at Bar-Ilan University. Worked first at Yad LaIsha and was also involved in establishing the Center for Women's Justice. And in all of her roles, she's been very involved in defending the rights of Agunot, of women denied their get by recalcitrant husbands. So we are so happy to have both of you with us today. Bruchot haba'ot. Thank you. Let me just talk about what we're going to do. We're going to talk, the panelists are going to talk for about 40 minutes, and then we will take questions from the video audience. The way that you ask questions is to type them. If you hover your cursor over the bottom of your screen, you will see a Q&A box, and if you click on it, you can type in a question. So the way to ask questions here is to type. All of your microphones are muted, and I will be tracking them and asking them on your behalf. So with that, I think that's enough. I'll give you the instructions. You can type the questions in as we're talking so that they're queued up when we pivot to that. And if you forget, jot it down. And as we transition to the Q&A part, I'll give you the instructions again. So I want to begin by asking each of you to talk a little bit more than either the written bios or the brief bio that I just gave, a little bit about your own personal perspective, to think about, to share with our audience your perspectives on the role of religion in general, and I would say halakha in particular, in public life. For those of us based here in the United States, we were raised on a system of separation of church and state. And so we had both freedom from any kind of religious expression that anyone, especially the government, imposes on it. And that creates a lot of space for freedom to religious expression. So there's a lot of religious diversity across the American landscape and across the Jewish landscape in America. And that is different in Israel, especially if one is, it has significant implications for Jews and for non-Jews. I think our conversation is significantly going to focus on the experience of Jews today. But so just to begin with, to kind of lay out the basic framework for our listeners about the role of religion in public life, and feel free to weave in your own stories and your own perspective from your professional vantage point. And Max, can I ask you to go first?
Okay, I was hoping for your aim.
You can start.
So look, Judaism, this is the only Jewish state on the planet, so it makes sense that Judaism infiltrates our life in many ways. In some ways, it's wonderful. It's very quaint. Our Kol Yisrael, the Voice of Israel, starts in the morning, 5 a.m, I think, with reading the Psalm of the day. And in fact, the sound of Kol Yisrael was da-da-da-da-da-da-da, which is Bereshit bara Elohim, the trope of Torah, starts the broadcasting of the Israeli radio. It's very moving. At the end of the programs, they play Hatikva. It's the last thing you hear before you go to sleep. On Yom Kippurim, on Day of Atonement, there is no law that demands that Israelis not ride their cars, but Israelis, on the whole, don't ride their cars. So a kid with a tricycle can actually ride on the Tel Aviv-Jerusalem highway on Yom Kippur, and it's fine. So there are things like that that are actually quite wonderful. None of them are coerced. The things that are not so wonderful is when coercion starts playing. And that's not because of halakha. It's not because of Jewish law. It's because of custom. Custom that serves the powers that be. And it's mostly about funding and power that these restrictions happen. I can talk about one of them is a radio station, which uses a government frequency. It's called Kol Barama. And that radio station doesn't allow women to speak. When a woman wants to give a recipe of the day, she wasn't allowed to read her name. A man would read out her recipe. They had exercise after birth that a man would actually deliver. Harmony in the home, early childhood education, all that stuff for women was delivered by men. When they had a direct call from the Knesset, they would beep out a woman politician speaking. So a very brave organization, Kolech, decided to fight this. And maybe, Yael, tell us how you won that case.
So Kol Barama was actually a long process. It was a lawsuit that took about 8 years. And between 2009 to 2011, when the radio channel started to broadcast, their their official policy was not to let women speak. I'm not talking about singing. I'm talking about speaking.
So and I think our folks like, that's Kol Isha. There's a
Kol Isha, it's a different discussion. Which,
oh yeah,
it's about singing, and that's not the topic here. The topic is about talking. That I'm an observant Jewish woman, knows halakha, and there is no halakha that says that women are not allowed to speak in public. And they decided to differentiate them for, I think, more of a matter of the way they wanted to present themselves and to differentiate them from other Haredi radio channels. And they said, we're not going to let women speak. Mm-hmm. And as a result, we approach on behalf of Haredi women. We took a survey in the Haredi world. I'm not Haredi. But we took a survey and we found out that there was about 40,000 women who said that they were hurt by the fact that women are not allowed to be heard. And as Anat mentioned before, the anomaly was really ridiculous, where it's either they didn't let women who are just audience to speak up and, you know, give a recipe, and it didn't matter whether it was a top lawyer in a big firm that won a law case that everybody wanted to hear about and it was in the news. They didn't let women speak. We were presenting these Haredi women in a class action, and after 8 years, we won, and the court found that we were right, and we fight for equality. And as a result, they've changed their policy, but not completely. I mean, they let women speak, and still they do only the recipes and the things that has to do with education, but still the main topics and the main programs are still without women. And they had to pay $1 million shekels for empowering religious Haredi and traditional women, and they had to pay damages. And it was important for us to people to understand that they need to pay for not letting women be part of the public sphere. And Professor Ohana Kehat, who founded Kolech, she led this whole this lawsuit, and we did it with the reform movement and with the Orly Erzlachovsky and with Orich Din Asaf Fink, and they did an amazing job, because it was an amazing precedent that actually we managed to win a case that on the top, it wasn't because of damaged goods, it was because women felt hurt by not letting them speak. But there is no doubt that this example shows us the complexity and the problems we are facing in Israel. I can say I grew up in the national religious community in Bnei Brak in different years. 40 years ago, Bnei Brak looked different. Bnei Akiva was the youth movement I used to go to. It was a large community of national religious. Nowadays, it's very different. I feel that I do live in a Jewish and democratic state. That's where I am. And I think that it is important that there is a place for the Jewish people. And it's as much as, I think it's more than just the fact that it's nice to wake up in the morning to the radio that starts with a tune that reminds us Torah reading. It's much more than that. I think that it should be, there should be elements of religion, but the way it's done now creates huge problems, especially for women. Unfortunately, when religion comes into the, that it comes through the government, something very bad happens to religion, and especially that everything has to do with women, because for some reason, they are the most to be hurt. And we see it in every arena, in every field. For instance, if we're talking about conversion, most of the converts are women. And as we know, it's becoming more and more complicated in Israel to be convert. And even for people who are coming from overseas, a lot of them are not being accounted as the converts. And if we go to every aspect of our life, we can see over and over again that originally, and again, I'm saying it's often not religion, but the way it goes through the government. And we see that the things that started with no, probably a lot of it, when Israel was founded, a lot of it was not really thoughtful. It was just being done for various reasons. And, you know, it's like if we think about the fact that Ben-Gurion gave this for Haredi community not to serve in the Israeli army. He thought that in a few years' time, there'll be no Haredi. Mm-hmm. And as a result, the Haredi community has grown and grown. And now when they are, their population is so big, the fact that they are not serving in the army is a great problem. and these things should be addressed. And unfortunately, what we can see over and over again, that the all these topics of religion and state becoming very difficult, and nobody really wants to touch it. And I can say that the religious parties, even the national religious parties, usually take stand like the Haredi community often when it comes to these issues, which puts us in a great problem.
So just to kind of reframe the question and lift up some of what you talked about, that I think that balance between democracy and religion, democracy and Judaism, and certainly from a liberal Zionist perspective, I think many folks feel that they are that they can be either mutually compatible, either aligned with each other, or when they're not, that they should be in a rich conversation to come up with the best possible balance. And what we see, I think, too often is, especially around the status of women, that either the Jewish trumps the democratic, or it's, and as Anat suggested, it's not necessarily halakha, it's not necessarily precise religion as it might be, the halachic or the religious principles as it might be understood, thousands of years old or through evolution changes, but a particular perspective empowered with state power, with the power of the government, with very, very significant impact. So you mentioned conversion. Can we turn the conversation to other areas where women are caught in the crossfires, really?
Marriage and divorce in Israel is one of the main problems. Unfortunately, again, the problem is that the government adopts Haredi views over things. And we know halakha and Torah has 70 faces and have various ways of dealing with things. And unfortunately, they take the stand of extremers, of the extreme right of the range. And then everybody, all of us, need to go according to that. And marriage and divorce is a great problem. Like, I would like to see that people have a way of choosing. They should choose how they want to get married. They should have civil marriage, and they should have different ways of marriage. And it shouldn't be only halachic orthodox through the Rabbanut. It should be much bigger than that. I find it difficult to believe in 2019, huge amount of people cannot get married in Israel. If they are without religion, if they're for various reasons are not allowed to marry halachically, they have no other way. And the fact that they in a democratic state, the fact that they need to go overseas in order to get married, and the problem gets even much more, much worse when we're talking about divorce, because even people who are trying to have civil marriage overseas, often because of, again, Anat said it in the beginning, because of power and power struggles, what we can see that the rabbinate send their like long hand to try and capture also people who got married in a different way. And we face great difficulties. A lot of women cannot really receive their freedom and receive their religious divorce certificate because the religious courts are holding positions that make their life very difficult, and they're exposed to a lot of extortion. And the husband should give his wife a get out of his free will. And instead of their judges using their power to force the get, often they said, we can't do anything. And of course they can, because halakha, I believe that halakha holechet, halakha is walking, halakha is changing in a certain way. I'm committed to halakha, to orthodox halakha, and I know that orthodox halakha can change.
And do you wanna chime in?
Yeah, I'm thinking that we don't have the wisdom of your Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson was a brilliant president of yours. I think there's a story that all the laureates of the Nobel Prize were having breakfast at the White House, and President Kennedy was asked, well, so much brain power in the White House. And he said, well, there must be here a lot of brain power, except when Jefferson was eating breakfast on his own. Really, so Jefferson says that in religion, it's the opposite than in politics. In politics, he says, united we stand, divided we fall. In religion, he says, it's the opposite. Divided we stand, united we fall. Mm-hmm. Israel is attempting to have one united religion, one way to get married, one way to keep Shabbat, one way to keep kashrut, one way to get buried, one way to get ordained as a rabbi, one way to be at the wall. And the lively core of argument that we have in our Jewish DNA, look at your own Friday night dinner, look how we spend our time. We are people who argue. We have a live core of arguing and looking at things from all directions. This died in Israel the minute government has gotten that power. And all we need is to just get government out. If government was out of it, I will agree that in Bnei Brak today, only an ultra-Orthodox rabbi probably fits the bill. But in Tel Aviv, a lesbian reform rabbi. Mm-hmm. And may the best rabbi win. Rabbis have to be, you know, in all my living adult days, I've never seen an ad rabbi wanted. Never seen it. Wow. Never seen an ad kashrut inspector needed. Never seen it. So you tell me, if there are 2,000 kashrut inspectors in Israel, how are they hired and fired if I've never seen an ad? How are all these rabbis that are fired and hired? I've seen rabbis being fired in America. I heard about that. I actually know some.
Yeah, yeah.
I've seen ad that the Oshkosh community is looking for a rabbi, and they will interview different candidates, and then they'll choose somebody. But state-paid rabbis in Israel, how are they hired?
Yeah,
it's a tzetzeles system. At one point I did a study in the Jerusalem municipality, how many people have to be fired from their jobs at the religious council if they have a direct family relation with one of the members of the council? My dear, it was all family members. It's all nepotism. Does that ensure quality? Look at our chief rabbis today. The two chief rabbis today, Rabbi Lau and Rabbi, help me here, Yosef, are the sons of the previous chief rabbis. You tell me, Deborah, in the sons of Moses were not continuing.
Guaranteed, right.
We don't believe in such a thing. And the two chief rabbis, there are only two families in Israel that can produce a chief rabbi. Only the Lau family and the Yosef family, that's it. We don't have any more. Craziness.
So the Reconstructionist movement was founded in the 20s, in the 1920s in America, on a commitment to diversity, on this recognition that there were many, many different ways to be Jewish, and that they were, that no one authority could say yes this or no that. And they were the early Reconstructionists around Mordecai Kaplan. They were passionate Zionists. They were very, very interested in the establishment of the State of Israel. But before statehood and into statehood, they were very, very worried about state-powered married to religious authority. They were deeply committed to democracy. They felt like democracy could enliven Judaism and help to make it really relevant, and that Judaism could enliven democracy. And they saw from their study of that, you know, they were writing in the 30s and the 40s with the rise of authoritarianism in Europe and in Russia. They were really worried about a religious authoritarianism. They were critical of the Catholic Church because there was a pope saying this way and not that way. And they were very, very worried, very prescient about concerns happening now, both the insistence of only one way, as opposed to a recognition of diversity, a recognition and embrace of diversity. And, you know, so it sounds like, Yael, you're pushing for a kind of pluralism within Jewish perspectives. And even as you're working toward the same goals, and not, you're looking for more of like a separation of church and state, like a, like that, that status issue should become secular as opposed to through the state power of the rabbinut. Am I hearing that correctly?
I'm not sure that Israel could actually separate church and state. But I think that the nepotism has to stop. That is, the religious council should be a department like the sports department, like the culture department. A professional will run it. The professional can be a woman. The professional can be an Arab. Yes. And if the person is sensitive, good, and fair, may the best person run our religious department. And the minute we will take it out of the hands of the few that have taken it, I think we're going to see a change. But I wanted to say something about Yael. I don't pay a price in my family, in my community, in my synagogue, or in my town for holding liberal views. Yael, as an Orthodox woman, is the bravest feminist I know, because she pays a price for saying these things. In the family, here Rosh Hashanah is coming. You, around your Rosh Hashanah table, Yael, everybody agrees with what you do. You probably are running a minefield in your family and a minefield in the community. It is so rare and courageous to hear such views from an Orthodox woman. And I think Kolech is one of the most important organizations in the ecology of plural, religious pluralism in Israel. And they are in a very difficult position, because liberal Jews, why would they support an Orthodox feminist organization? And Orthodox Jews will not support them. So where are they?
So I feel that nowadays, I think that the most brave women are actually coming from the Haredi community. Mm. And there is a tremendous change inside that community. And these women are doing what the pioneers did in my community 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And they are curving, trying to find their way and paying a huge price each one of them. They are like, it's a new generation of these women. They are thriving for very basic things, like to be elected. The Haredi parties do not let women in. So they are in a very beginning of this whole thing, but they're doing amazing stuff, whether it's finding, exposing sexual abuse in the Haredi community, whether it's helping divorce women. And they're now starting a process that in my community already started 20 years ago when Kolech was founded. And I feel that in my community, things are changing slowly, but you, in some ways, some slowly and some quicker. Depends how you look at it. Overall, I do feel that from a small group of women that founded Kolech 20 years ago, there are many more of us nowadays, and therefore we can say what we think out loud. But it's a constant struggle in our communities. Baruch Hashem, I'm lucky to have an extremely supported family and close friends, but there is no doubt that as soon as you get out there, it's getting harder. And yet I see the change. I see that things are changing. And the way I look at it, I'm driven to create this change for the next generation to come.
Why do you think a reform person like me and an Orthodox person like you, if we were from the male persuasion, could not have the partnership that we have?
I'm not sure. Could you repeat that?
If you were a male Orthodox guy.
Yeah.
And I was a male reform guy. And do you think we could have had the partnership we had?
Nope. Because I think
Why?
Because women have this ability to create a change. It's less about hierarchy. It's really, I mean, we are sitting together and we have mutual things that we do together, because with all the differences that we have, and we have differences, we have differences in the way we perceive, we percept halakha, and the way we think, and sometimes even our vision can be different, although there are a lot of, I think that there is much more in common than less. And we, like, for instance, we used to sit in a coalition of women organizations for Mesorovot Get Ve'agunot, Ikar, to try and solve the issue of Mesorovot, women who can't get, who can't receive their religious get. And we still haven't managed to get to the solution. But I think that because of this, like, we can see the common things between us and do things together. And I think rabbis from Orthodoxy are very, very afraid. There is a lot, people are afraid because the religious establishment controls all the important places in Israel, like to control, for instance, if you are an Orthodox rabbi and you cooperate with the Reform movement, then tomorrow they would take away your certificate, your ability to marry couples. So they use this power to try and frighten everybody, so there is less room to cooperate. Anat, do you agree?
I'm not sure. I think that being women is part of it, but I think we have nothing to lose. We're not part of the establishment. All we have to lose is our shackles that are keeping us in our place. God willing, if we do get into power, we would still have this affinity. We'll be able to be still bold and courageous and say to the religious establishment, we're bringing something new into the system. But you're right. Fear is what I see in the men that are in power is tremendous fear. Rabbis are afraid, are becoming more and more extreme. Their religiosity is determined by how far they are from women or how strict they are with women. So, for example, if my rabbi is very modest and he only meets with women of the congregation, oh, but my rabbi is even more. He keeps the cleanliness of the eyes. He doesn't look at any woman if she's not his daughter, his wife, or his mother. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And my rabbi is even so pure. He meets women through a piece of wood. He doesn't look at any woman whatsoever, even his daughter and his the zealotry and the competition to become more and more religious, and the religiosity, the scale of religiosity is how far you are from women and how clean you keep yourself from there, because they ooze all these. I don't know what their problem is with women, but they're numerous.
Well, so I want to remind listeners that they can type questions. One person already has, but looking ahead, just by hovering your cursor over the bottom of your screen, the Q&A box will pop up. I want to actually go back, picking up on what you were just saying, Anat, to something that Yael said earlier about how Haredi women are stepping forward in the way that Orthodox women did 20 years ago. So, you know, when I talk about my analysis about the status of women comes, I'm very comfortable claiming it from a feminist perspective. I wonder what's beyond what Anat just said about there's really nothing to lose. What is the self-understanding and the motivating energy that non-liberal, like there's a liberal analysis that says there should be equality, but someone who was within a Haredi system and who presumably wants to stay within the Haredi community and wants it to change, what's the rationale? What's the starting impulse that do they see more liberal culture or secular culture and say we want that, or how are they able to offer up the critique that says wait, there's nothing that should stop us from being elected or expressing our voice? What is the thinking?
I, Yeah, so I think first of all, nowadays, Haredi community, because of computers, because of internet, is more open. I mean, more women. Women are actually the ones that are in the working force more than men. And they learn and they work and they see the world. So first they, you know, for many years they've been unexposed to the world, and now they are. So changes are happening everywhere. And as always happen, I mean, when there is knowledge and there is exposure to ideas, so women see it and they say, we want it too. And just like, again, I see as a religious person, I feel that I'm Orthodox and I'm a feminist, and I'm not just one of them. I believe that I can live my life being Orthodox and feminist, you know, parallel, side by side. And I need to find my way with it. And sometimes it's difficult. And then but I do want to have a coherent world where I can live with these two identities. And I feel that a lot of times that identities that sometimes contradict each other, these are the parts that we work on them the most. And then you try to find your way in it. And you said, for instance, if you look at halacha, you're saying, if you see issues that are trying to put women down, you realize sometimes that it's not the halacha, it's not the tradition, it's the way men explained it, translated it. So you can see the changes. I mean, we can see that if you look at the text, often you see that it's not necessarily putting women down. It was done afterwards, and then you're looking to find the voice of women that were not heard. You understand that halacha, in order to stay alive, needs to create change, and you realize that the text was written in a certain time. And you see the differences, and you see that halacha kept answering and finding solutions in order to be alive. So you understand that it can be done also for that, because in halacha you can see lots of halachic solutions that were often were taken for issues that raised from as we went in history. So you realize that these changes are needed inside, and the idea is to create the change inside. The same with Haredi women. They feel obligated to the Haredi world. They want to be part. And to be part is a lot of power. To be part of society, of community, of family, it's not something that people want to leave. I mean, if they were thrown up, it's a different story. But when you have all of that, you do want, I understand this feel, this need to find how to work it out between the two worlds. And so it's not just natural that now Haredi women trying to find their voice inside their community. And they realize that a lot of things that they were told is not really their religion. And now they're working to pave their way.
So we're going to be shifting to questions in about just about 3-4 minutes, but I just want to raise one more topic before we do that. And it's something that Anat, you pointed us to when we were preparing for this call, which is to say that life in Israel is shaped by two major forces. One we've been talking a lot about, religion. Another is the army. And women have a different status in the army as well. So just to kind of put that on the table before we open it up for questions. And again, folks can type in their questions in the Q&A section. So just some reflections on women and the army in Israeli society, Jewish women, I guess.
Well, if you look at the Knesset, you see that we have 120 members in our parliament, and around 40 every time, that's one third, are rabbis and generals. Rabbis, generals, colonels, people whose career came from the army, people whose career came from religion. That's a huge proportion. And these are two patriarchies that place women at a very subordinate role. And when I look at how Israel progressed on some of the major issues that we have in front of us, for example, peace, we haven't made a lot of headway with this leadership. And I'm looking at where do we see the incubation of women's leadership? I see that these are two big incubators of male leadership. Where do we see, well, you're seeing it right in front of you, both the leader of Kolich and the leader of the Israel Religious Action Center and the Women of the Wall, we are the NGOs of Israel. There are 32,000 NGOs in Israel, and they're absolutely dominated by women. If you look at their employees, if you look who runs them, the NGOs of Israel are the big incubator of women's leadership. And we see already in the Knesset some of these leaders that were came out of the NGOs. Mm-hmm. Just a word about the ultra-Orthodox women. Those brave, brave feminists realized, yes, like Yael said brilliantly, through education, they have realized that they are people. The revolutionary notion that women are people entered their mind. Where are they stuck? They're not sure that Arabs are people. They're not sure that gay people are people. And that's where they're still part of their community, in that they've not been able to look at the eye of a non-Jew and realize another revolutionary notion. Palestinian is a person too.
but you know what? I think that actually I always say that a woman is the ultimate other in Judaism, in Orthodoxy. And as we manage to change the views of people regarding women, it's our it's opening the door actually for accepting the fact that Palestinians are humans and others, they're all others that actually slowly but surely are going to get in.
And that's why... Most of the head of the class. Wonderful. Yeah.
No, I was thinking so much about empathy when you were talking earlier, that the empathy is not only, you know, that it's about once we, this realization that we have about ourselves, then that to me, that is the Jewish value that informs my democratic commitment. You know, that whatever I want for myself, that other people have this aspiration, that part of my job is to help them to realize it. This, you know, fighting for my liberation is bound up in fighting for their liberation. So, okay, so we're about 15 minutes from wrapping up, and I want to invite our listeners to ask questions. There's one I want to bring forward from and someone who hasn't identified themselves on the call. You can type in your name or you can just say anonymous. Here's the question. It's about the elections, the topic of the day. The Israeli elections are next week. To what extent are women's rights in Israel an electoral issue? Do people think about women's rights at all before casting their vote?
Not at all. Not at all. I'll tell you why. Because the agenda is set by the two major dominant forces in Israel, the army, security issues, and the religion. And if you look at the agenda of this election, it's certainly dominated by these two forces. Women think it's a luxury to, even women would consider it a luxury to look at their own, for example, equal pay for equal work, which does not happen in Israel very often. Even women who show that I was able to show to them that they're making 50% less than men felt that their other issues way more important. In all municipalities, by the way, in Israel, women make 50% less than men.
Unfortunately, we're not there yet, and we are part of coalition of women organizations, and we keep telling people you should, you know, think about women issues before you vote. But I think that security here still, unfortunately, as much as we're trying to make people aware and pay attention of social issues, at the end of the day, that's what people look at. And therefore, all other topics just not really exist, unfortunately.
But we don't despair. The one thing we have is hope. Tikva is our only hope. And I think if the right-wing parties talk about the things that we should be afraid of, put dread into our hearts. It's the center and the left that has to talk about a new vision and about tikva, about hope. And when I see so many leftists, so many people on the left give up to despair right now, then the left is losing the one thing that it has, and that is giving people a vision of a new world, a new order, a new priority. So despair is not part of the agenda.
Ruth Messenger, who is the head of the American Jewish World Service here in America, said to activists, despair is not a strategy.
Yep.
It's not a strategy. And I thought
smart lady.
And so I want to encourage our listeners again, if you want to ask a question, to type it. You look at the bottom of your monitor for the icon that reads question and answer, and then type it. Right now, we don't have any additional questions. We have lots of people on, but no. Here we go. Hannah Katzman asks, I would like to understand the logic behind Kolech's statement supporting holding the concert in Afula with the mechitza in a public park, despite the prohibition against signs or barriers in public spaces, and that this is a longstanding practice for you. She adds, she understands that the reason to keep good relations with the Haredi community and that there were many Haredi activist women who support the separations, but what about supporting all women and not only Haredi women?
Okay, hi Hannah. we know each other. And yes, what we I know that what we said was a bit complicated, or not exactly what wasn't exactly the easy way of the position we took was a bit complicated. The idea was that after actually looking at it from all angles, we realized that out of 300 performances that were in Afula, there was only one for the Haredi community. And the Haredi women proclaimed that usually they're not allowed in at all. And it was also outstanding for them, the fact that it was a one-time event that they were able to participate. And from their point of view, they preferred to have that in separation rather than not to have it at all, which is what they usually have. And therefore, we thought that it was, performance was supposed to be happen this way in separation, as much as we do not encourage separation and we definitely not want it to become a standard. But sometimes you feel that, again, from understanding the Haredi community and the way it works, the feeling was that actually it was wasting energy, not necessarily on the right thing. And therefore we said that they should have let them perform this way. What we are facing nowadays is actually some sort of a backlash, because again, the Haredi community become bigger and greater. And 10 years ago, rarely would they have performances at all. And now as they're becoming a large community and they gain more power, then these issues are raising up. And if years ago they wouldn't make a fuss or a problem if a performance like that would be happened together or in separation, now they ought to make it in separation. So we just thought that this particular event, we should have let that happen without making a big fuss, just because there are so many other places that we could fight for.
I want to answer this too. Hannah, listen, we, as you know, we represented most of these cases on segregation and separation. We would not have taken this case, could have taken it, we didn't. And the reason is that we realize that bad cases make bad laws. And as a result of the Afula and the, in my opinion, misguided petition, there will be laws that we will all regret that would come out of this next Knesset. So this was a not a wise move, Of course, you know, Kol Barama, El Al, the buses, they were good moves and did not yield a counter backlash law. This one will. And it was a mistake.
Mm. He's already.
I'm with Polech on that. Mm.
Mm. Yeah, Hannah adds in, it's a dangerous precedent. She's agreeing.
Smart.
I have a Tachlis question from Beatrice Kahn that just for everyone who asks, will we be sharing the recording? And the folks from Partners says that this recording will be available on their website on Friday. So a question from Tali Kritzman Amir. Most of the battles you described took place in the court. Is there any hope to promote women's right in other ways? Are there other agencies through the political sphere on the local level? So what beyond legal remedies?
Definitely. Well, what Tali is her name?
Yes.
Tali, look at the women of Beit Shemesh. This is not the court. Women of Beit Shemesh are activists on the ground. They changed the mayor of Beit Shemesh. Aliza Bloch this week got the police to put cameras in the central squares to see who is writing graffiti against women and who is writing, you know, saying that women have to dress modestly in the public sphere. And this is, the activists of Beit Shemesh are such a source of hope that they didn't use the legal tool very often. They were activists. And that's pretty terrific. Another group that's doing making history with on the ground is Women of the Wall. 31 years at the wall, monthly prayer, regardless of what resistance there is. I think civil disobedience and activism is a very important component. Don't you, Yael?
Yes, I think that a lot of our work is actually grassroots. For instance, we initiated Shabbat Roshotov, a Shabbat that once a year we have women scholars all over Israel in Orthodox shuls all over are giving speeches and lessons from the pulpit in front of all men, women, and teens. And we held it this year for the fourth time. We had 100 scholars in over 200 communities,
wonderful,
one Shabbat. And this is creating a change because what happens in all these communities, there is this Shabbat brings to the front the what role women should take in the community. And in a lot of places, it was the first time ever women stood in shul and gave a speech for everybody. And now they're having discussions of whether women should be part of board members, of gabayot, of giving more lessons. So we can see that you start something in actually moving on to lots of other things. So we do a lot of grassroots, for sure.
I have a question for you, Deborah.
Yes?
How about doing a panel of daughters of Abraham, having a Christian, a Muslim, a Jew, and looking at how the Abrahamic religions are curtailing, in Israel, curtailing our abilities to express our religion and also to be with each other?
So I am moderating at the invitation of Partners for Progressive Israel, and what you just named, Anand, is a core commitment of the Reconstructionist movement, where we do multi-faith work frequently within Abrahamic religions. So I would be so happy to be a part of exactly that conversation.
I can give you the Muslim. I met one this week that is, her English just shocked me, and her Arabic, and her Hebrew, and she's just, and she gave, suddenly I realized this is my sister. Wow.
And we have connections to folks probably from the Christian and the Muslim community, so I would be so happy to be a part of that.
Okay, so we have a Tachlis plan for the future.
Good, good. And this is a good time for us to wind down because we're coming right up against our time limit. I want to ask you, is there anything that either of you would want to say in a siyum as a kind of a wrap up? For
yes. I want to wish everybody who's watching us a Shana Tova. This is my shofar. I blew it at the Kotel. This is a year of hope. May we all have a healthy and happy year. A year of tikva. Tikva is our only hope.
Yeah,
everybody. Shana Tova. And I'm sure, like, overall, we struggled a lot, but we also see good things are happening. The change is here in religious society, in Orthodox society, in Haredi society. Things are changing, and Im Yirtzeh Hashem, they should change for the good. And we should all
amen. Amen, amen. Toda, Deborah.
Oh, my great honor. And thank you to the folks at Partners for Progressive Israel for organizing this. I want to thank everybody who's joined in for this conversation with Israel and Palestine. I want to thank Yael Lachman and Anat Huffman for your wonderful conversation, and for all the staff at Partners for their work in making this discussion happen. You can go to progressiveisrael.org, one word, to learn more about Partners for Progressive Israel and their future programs, including maybe the one that Anat suggested. And I want to add my wishes of a Shana Tova, Mitzuka, a sweet and a happy and a healthy new year, full of hope, full of change for all of us. Take good care.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.